Philip Pullman is a hugely successful and sometimes controversial author whose books are enjoyed by people around the world. Many of his books are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including his best-known work.
Lyra moaned and trembled uncontrollably, just as if she had been pulled out of water so cold that her heart had nearly frozen. Pantalaimon simply lay against her bare skin inside her clothes, loving her back to herself, but aware all the time of Mrs. Coulter, busy preparing a drink of something.
His Dark Materials is a trilogy of fantasy novels set across parallel worlds. Its teenage hero, Lyra, must follow her destiny to discover the nature of dust, cosmic particles that fall to Earth and lie at the heart of religious belief in Lyra's world. Now, 17 years on, Philip Pullman is back with a new trilogy, The Book of Dust. The first volume, La Belle Sauvage, starts 10 years before his Dark Materials, when Lyra is a baby. It features a flood of biblical proportions, a pair of brave young rescuers, and a cast of sinister spies in a darkly brilliant odyssey of adventures. And I'm delighted to be joined by its author. Philip Pullman, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
I know many people, including most of my own family, have reread his Dark Materials several times, but what drew you back into Lyra's world?
Well, in a sense, I never left it, because I've written two little books in between the end of his Dark Materials and the coming of this book. One was called Lyra's Oxford, and the other was a book which I had great fun writing about the first meeting between the balloonist Lee Scoresby and the armoured bear, Yorick Birnerson. It's called Once Upon a Time in the North. So in a sense, I've been sort of living one foot in and one foot out of Lyra's world ever since I first thought of it. But I could see a longer story gathering, like a storm gathering in the sky, in the distant sky. And I couldn't help being intrigued enough to go back there and think about it and make it into a story.
It's set in Oxford. What do you think it is about Oxford that has produced so many wonderful writers of fantasy and allegory like C.S. Lewis, Lewis Carroll, Tolkien, and yourself?
Oh, it's something in the water. At least that's the only explanation I can give. It's an unlikely sort of place. One of the unlikeliest things I ever heard of concerns All Souls College, which in about 1300 or 1400, I can't remember which, at Christmas time, was interrupted, or their carol service was interrupted, or something, by a duck that flew in. So naturally they caught it and ate it. 100 years later, they decided to commemorate this, and they had a wooden duck on a stick made, which they followed around the college singing Latin hymns. And they've done it every 100 years since, except in the year 2000, when in the interests of sexual equality, they had a female duck rather than a drake. So that's Oxford is the sort of place where that happens. The other attraction for Oxford, as far as I'm concerned, is that I live there and I don't have to go very far to look things up. And of course, it's got one of the great libraries of the world, the Bodleian Library, which I use extensively.
And I suppose it's also a confluence of scientific and artistic thinking, all within a relatively small area.
That's certainly true. If you want to ask about anything in the fields of science or philosophy or metaphysics or there's an expert just down the road at the end of a phone call, and they're generally very, very helpful with their time and their advice. So it's a very hard place to go away from. I suppose the other thing is that once a little tradition has been established, then other people go there and add to it. I can't say whether I went to Oxford because of Lewis Carroll and J.R.R. Tolkien, but I probably wasn't surprised to find myself there because of that.
And is there any coincidence in the fact that one of the heroes of La Belle Sauvage is called Alice? Is it an echo of Alice in Wonderland, perhaps?
No, I didn't think of that until afterwards. And then somebody said, oh, you've written a book about it. Oh, yes, I have written a book about Alice in a way. But it's a very different Alice. There's another connection. I mean, it involves a ride in a boat. And, of course, the original Alice began because Charles Dodgson, Lewis Carroll, went out for a row on the river with a friend of his and with Alice and her sister, I think, the original Alice Liddell. So there's a sort of connection which I can't deny. But I don't think I did it on purpose.
The river plays an enormous and very fast-flowing part in the book. One of your Egyptian characters refers to it as the secret commonwealth. This is something that I believe you're going to explore more in the sequel.
Yes. The flood is very important. The book opens in Oxford, but the flood carries them away, carries our protagonists away, including Lyra, who's only 6 months old or so in this book. So the whole aim of the book is to look after Lyra, and that's what the hero Malcolm and his slightly unwilling sidekick Alice find themselves doing. But yes, the book does become, how shall I say, well, it enters Fairy Queen territory. I mean Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, the immense long 16th century poem, which I never read when I was a student at Oxford, which I should have done, but I read since and found wonderful. And yes, the secret commonwealth is a phrase which I introduced deliberately into the book because that's the title of an odd little book by a man called Robert Kirk in about 1670 or so. He was a clergyman and he wrote The Secret Commonwealth. The full title is The Secret Commonwealth of Elves, Fauns and Fairies, as a means of writing down aspects of folklore. Stories about fairies and fairyland and elves and semi-spiritual creatures like that, which I found fascinating.
Are you going to use that as a counterpoint to the organised religion under the Magisterium, which is still very much a part of La Belle Sauvage as well?
Well, yes. That's a fairly obvious way to go, but that's the way I'm going. One thing I learned in writing His Dark Materials was not to be afraid of the obvious. It was obvious, for example, as soon as I thought of it, that Yorick Byrnison, the armoured bear in the first story, would turn out to be a king in exile. And my first thought when I came to that was, oh, no, that's obvious. Everybody else expects that. It's done before hundreds of times. But then I thought, no, this is what he is. Let's not be afraid of the obvious. So I went for that, and I think it worked. So I'm not going to be afraid of the obvious in this either.
La Belle Sauvage is the craft that Malcolm and Lyra and Alice use to survive the flood. It's also indicative of the fact that there's beauty and savagery in the book, maybe more so than in His Dark Materials. Is that reflective of a greater extremism that you see around you?
I think when I was writing the book, I'd have had to say, no, it isn't. It's just the way the story's going. But since then, and it's taken me a long time to write, since then I see that, yeah, it is in a way reflective of things that are happening in the world. The world has not become a kinder, softer, gentler place in the last 17 years. And I think that's going to come out more clearly in the second and the third book, even than it does in the first one.
Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away. And he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage. A witty acquaintance thought it amusing to scrawl an S over the V, and Malcolm patiently painted it out 3 times before losing his temper and knocking the fool into the water, at which point they declared a truce. Like every child of an innkeeper, Malcolm had to work around the tavern, washing dishes and glasses, carrying plates of food or tankards of beer, retrieving them when they were empty. He took the work for granted. The only annoyance in his life was a girl called Alice, who helped with washing the dishes. She was 15 years old, tall and skinny, with lank, dark hair that she scraped back into an unflattering ponytail. Lines of self-discontent were already gathering on her forehead and around her mouth. She teased Malcolm from the day she arrived. "Who's your girlfriend, Malcolm? Ain't you got a girlfriend? Who was you out with last night? Did you kiss her? Ain't you ever been kissed?" He ignored that for a long time. But finally, Aster leaped at Alice's scrawny jackdaw demon, knocking him into the washing-up water, and then biting and biting the sodden creature till Alice screamed for pity. She complained bitterly to Malcolm's mother, who said, "Serves you right. I got no sympathy for you. Keep your nasty mind to yourself." From then on, she did.
Yes, certainly you have some unpleasant organisations within the book. I'm thinking especially of the League of St. Alexander, who are a cross between the Stasi and the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Or the Hitler Youth, indeed, or the whatever it was they called the youth organisation in Soviet Russia. Bands of young people driven by a kind of ideology, by a zealotry, and encouraged in this wickedness by their elders. Yes, it's something I found pretty chilling.
Without wishing to give any spoilers, there's also a very unpleasant child molester in the book. Is he there as a reflection of the different ways in which youth can be corrupted, either by ideology or physically?
You could see it like that, but again, it wasn't like that to me, or he wasn't like that when I was writing him. When I was writing him, he was a villain. He was as creepy as I could make him. But as with all villains and villainy, it's more fun to write about them. You can't have people being good all the time. Well, there wouldn't be any story at all.
I know you're very against the labelling of books for age bands or, you know, what sex the reader is. But what guidelines do you impose on yourself when you're writing a book that you know is going to be read by children and young adults?
Well, that's the way I put it. I don't think this book is for 12-year-olds and upwards or whatever. I think this book might include, if I'm lucky, some young people and some older people. That being the case, the only guideline I impose is of telling the story as well as I possibly can. I think, though, yes, having an awareness of a wide audience, which is something I'm very lucky to have, means you have to be, I think, a little extra careful in your storytelling. You can't frighten the grown-ups too much, you see.
That's a lovely way of putting it, yes. And one of your, I think arguably one of your greatest inventions is the demon character. The fact that demons don't take their form until after a child has hit puberty, is that something to do with the nature and nurture debate as to the characters that we assume when we become adults?
Yes, it does. But I'm not specific about it because I want it to be open to interpretation and imagination too. I thought of the demon not at the very beginning when I first began this story. It was just Lyra going into a room where she wasn't supposed to be and things following from that. But I found that was something wasn't working. But as soon as I discovered she had a demon, at last they could talk together. And she could say, let's go. And he'd say, no, we mustn't. And she said, oh, don't be such. And so they could talk and advise and console and frighten each other and excite each other and encourage each other. And it made the story work much more easily at that early stage. When I realised that the demon could change shape, I thought, well, yeah, that's interesting. But interesting in what way? What does it do? What does it tell us? And it didn't really tell us anything. Until I realised that it was children's demons that change shape and adults' demons are fixed. That was the moment when I saw I could tell a story that I'd been, well, waiting all my life to tell, really, which is since my own adolescence, which is the difference between innocence and experience, in William Blake's terms.
What form would your demon take?
Well, I don't know, but I think if I had to guess, she would be a bird, and she'd be a bird of the corvid family, one of those birds that steals things. The Jackdaw of Reims, for example, or the magpie in the Tintin story of the Bianca Castafiore emerald. Wonderful, wonderful story. Or a raven, as in Edgar Allan Poe's raven. I think she'd be a raven, really, because the raven is the image of the trickster in many, well, North American myths, and of the storyteller, too. So I like to think that my demon is a raven.
I believe you based the character of Hannah Ralph on somebody who introduced you to books and reading.
The character of Hannah Ralph is, well, sort of some of the circumstances of her life. Some of her way of proceeding is based on a friend of mine, Dinah Birch, who's a vice-chancellor of Liverpool University, as a matter of fact. But that's just the one aspect of her, one aspect of Dinah Birch and one aspect of Hannah Ralph. The person who lies behind the story in a deeper sense is my old teacher, Miss Jones, Miss Enid Jones, at Ysgol Ardudwy in Harlech, where I spent my years from 11 to 18, my secondary schooling. She was a wonderful teacher, and she took an interest in me, I suppose, because I was passionate about reading and about books and about writing too, and I was very fond of her.
And it's a great gift to give anybody to introduce them to reading. The heroes of your books do fight back against injustice or threat. I can't imagine you think much of the snowflake generation.
That's an interesting question. I tell you one thing I don't think much of, and that's the word snowflake. Because it implies a sort of wimpishness among people who don't like tough things like right-wing politicians. If you're mildly left-wing, or if you're mildly liberal, you're a snowflake. No, you're not. What a ridiculous way of talking about people. I don't like that term, and I don't like the implication it has that if you're on the left or liberal or something, you're a bit of a wimp. It's not true, and I don't like it.
Yes, and it closes down debate and curiosity, which I think is at the heart of Lyra, Alice, Malcolm, Will. They are young people who learn as they go along.
You couldn't be more right. That's exactly correct. I was once asked, to my great surprise, to preach a sermon in the university church in Oxford. And so I took it terribly seriously, and I got the kit, you know, the sort of ribbons that go around your neck and the black cassock and all the rest of it. And I stood up in the pulpit, and I preached about virtue. And I talked about the seven Christian virtues, which, of course, begin with faith, hope and charity. And I said, they're all very well, they're all fine, I like them all, I approve of them all except faith. I'm not keen on blind faith. Instead, I'd rather substitute another virtue, which is curiosity. And I like to think that the protagonists in my stories do exemplify this. They are curious, they're interested in things, they're curious about where we come from, why we're here. They've got an intellectual curiosity, a metaphysical curiosity. They're curious about the world and the universe and why we're here. And I admire that and I enjoy it.
We're sitting in the RNIB Talking Books studios where audio copies of books are made. I believe you yourself read the His Dark Materials trilogy for the audiobooks and used actors for some of the parts of Lee Scoresby and so on and so forth.
That's right, yeah. That was a big production. It wasn't my decision to use actors in the parts, but I was very glad they did, although I wanted to do the bear. I always wanted to do the bear. And Sean Barrett did the bear instead. He did it very well. No, I was doing the narration, and actors were doing, including some of the cast of The Archers, which was a strange experience. Lissy Pargiter being Mrs. Coulter. But this time, I simply didn't have the time. It's a long process, as you know, and for someone who isn't professionally involved in it all the time, there are a lot of starts and stomach noises and mistakes and so on. So you have to take a lot longer than professional actors. And we were very lucky to get Michael Sheen to do the whole story this time as a solo, and he did it brilliantly.
Yes, it's a really compelling read. Were you involved in the decision to choose him?
Yeah, he'd got in contact with me and said how much he'd enjoyed His Dark Materials, very looking forward to the new one, and if there was a chance of having anything to do with the new version for TV that's being prepared of His Dark Materials, he'd be very interested in that. Well, at the time, they hadn't begun that, but I did mention that to the producers of the audiobook that Michael Sheen might be a candidate, and he was kind enough to do it.
And will Michael Sheen be reading the sequel?
Well, I hope so, in due course. The sequel isn't ready to be published yet. It's written, but it's not yet edited and chopped about and cut and amended and so on. And I got all that work to do before we can even think of publishing it, let alone making the audiobook.
Can you give us any indication of what's to come in The Secret Commonwealth?
Well, yes. I've said that the first book is, although it's set 10 years before His Dark Materials, is not a prequel. I just don't like that word. And the second part and the third part are set about 10 years after the events of His Dark Materials, but they're not sequels. So it's not a prequel and it's not a sequel, it's an equel. That's my one soundbite that I've been trolling around ever since I thought of it. In the second book and the third book, Lyra is going to be about 20. She'll be an undergraduate. And the consequences of the events and the ideas that are set in place in La Belle Sauvage will be a long time germinating, 20 years or so, but they will begin to sprout and then blossom and flower and produce whatever spines or thorns or poison they do. in The Secret Commonwealth, which is the second book, and the third book, which I haven't yet written.
Are you a man who plans out your books, or do you let them grow as you write?
Oh, I plan them meticulously after I've written them. I have to write it first to see what it's going to be about. I don't know yet. When I start, I've got to be surprised. Otherwise, the thought of working for 7 years to tell a story, all of which you know intimately already, it just chills the blood. I couldn't do it. I'd go mad. No, I do take them apart and put them together again meticulously after I've written them. I think that's the right way to do it.
Well, I will keep my fingers crossed for more armoured bears in the next couple of books. But in the meantime, Philip Pullman, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.